tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Kenya Muslims defy terrorists. Islamist gunmen ambushed a bus traveling from Nairobi to Mandera, Kenya on Monday and demanded the passengers separate into groups of Christians and Muslims. But Muslim passengers refused these orders, protecting their Christian counterparts. Jill Craig has reaction from Nairobi.
Gunmen believed to be Al-Shabaab supporters shot at a bus in North Kenya's Mandera County Monday. But the passengers aboard the bus attacked Monday showed unusual bravery. Witnesses say some Muslim passengers gave headscarves to non-Muslims to help them conceal their identities, likely remembering a previous attack in Mandera last year when militants killed 28 non-Muslims taken off a bus. According to local officials, the attackers ordered everyone off the bus and to separate into two groups of Muslims and non-Muslims. But passengers refused, telling the militants to kill them all. The gunmen soon left. Nairobi resident Mahamud Mohammed says this show of solidarity demonstrates the Kenyan spirit.
And from now, we the Muslims will be the forefront to fight terrorism.
Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Al-Shabaab has staged a number of deadly attacks in Kenya since 2011. Iraqi troops closed in on Islamic State fighters today in central Ramadi, where they're trying to retake the city they lost 7 months ago. In the second day of a major offensive, forces led by an elite counterterrorism unit pushed toward the government complex. Iraqi Lieutenant General Anwar Hama Amin says the army is moving slowly into the city to take over government buildings. There are a lot of booby traps planted by ISIS, so this is slowing down the liberation process. But once government complexes are controlled, the rest of Ramadi will be easily liberated. This is VOA News. A British lawmaker has written to Prime Minister David Cameron asking him to challenge the United States after a British Muslim family was denied permission to travel to Southern California at the last minute. A Disneyland vacation for Mohammed Tariq Mahmoud and his family was inexplicably interrupted. Mr. Cameron's office said the Prime Minister will look into the lawmaker's claim. Stella Creasy, a member of British Parliament, told British newspapers that she's concerned that a growing number of British Muslim families are being denied entry to the U.S. with no reason given. The Afghan government has sent reinforcements to the besieged southern district of Helmand province after Taliban militants captured large parts of the area in recent days. Fighting continues as army and police arrive to help security forces after days of clashes. The Taliban began their advance on the Sangin district on Sunday after storming government buildings and capturing the administrative center. Amnesty International added to the criticism of Russia's air campaign in Syria with a new report Wednesday saying the bombings have killed at least 200 civilians in Homs, Idlib, and Aleppo provinces. The rights group said the Russian airstrikes have hit homes and hospitals and that its research showed there were no fighters or military targets nearby. A Russian court has issued an international arrest warrant for Mikhail Khodorkovsky, former Yukos oil chief and critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Russian police say that Mr. Khodorkovsky is accused of ordering the killing of the mayor of a Siberian oil town. Mr. Khodorkovsky denies the charges, calling them a response to his pro-democracy work. And protests in Ethiopia's Oromia region have entered their second month. The Oromo people are opposing a plan to expand the capital while voicing other grievances, such as their feeling that the government is preventing them from gaining any power. Marta Vanderwolf reports for VOA.
Schools are closed. Businesses just reopened after being closed for almost a week, and there's tension in the small town of Gingi, about 80 kilometers west of Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Police are on the main road, and interviews have to be conducted on the basis of anonymity and on the outskirts of the town. One waitress says that despite the cafe being open again, things are not back to normal yet. She says there's not an official curfew and that young people risk being randomly detained if they are out in the evening. The most recent protest in Gingi was last weekend after a funeral. Citizens say security forces killed three people before the protest took place. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Rights organizations say the government is using excessive lethal force on the protesters. This is Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Protests in Ethiopia's Oromia region have entered their second month. The Oromo people are opposing a plan to expand the capital while voicing other grievances, such as their feeling that the government is preventing them from gaining any power.
That's Martha van der Wolf reporting from Addis Ababa. Details coming up. Also in the news, a rights group says the killing of hundreds of members of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria by the army appears to have been wholly unjustified. And more migrants and refugees died today trying to reach Europe. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, a rights group says the killing of hundreds of members of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria by the army appears to have been wholly unjustified. The raids occurred from December 12th through the 14th in the town of Zaria 9 days ago. Human Rights Watch Africa Director Daniel Bakala says the Nigerian military claimed that residents tried to assassinate Army Chief General Tukar Buratai is not credible. The residents are Shia Muslims. The violence began when residents threw stones at the general's convoy. From New York, Bakala spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about why he believes the Nigerian military claims are not credible.
We have been investigating this unfortunate incident in northern Nigeria in Kaduna State, and we have interviewed several witnesses almost immediately after the incident happened in at least two of the locations, interviewing both victims and witnesses of what has happened. And if you really look at the Nigerian military's version of the events, it simply does not stack up. We know that there was a confrontation and a protest between this religious minority sect of Shia Muslims in Nigeria with Nigerian military forces, but the response from the Nigerian military forces is quite heavy-handed, which has led into the deaths of hundreds of people and hundreds more being wounded. At best, this is a terrible overreaction, and at worst, it's a provocation and a planned attack on a minority religious group.
Why do you doubt the Nigerian military claim that this was an attempted assassination on the army general?
Yeah, the Nigerian military claims this was an attempted assassination, but the evidences we have gathered so far indicates sort of angry young men, protesters, erected roadblocks and prevented the convoy of the military chief from passing by. But it is just simply impossible that people armed with sticks and stones and have just erected roadblocks could lead into such an attack, leading into deaths of hundreds and hundreds of people. You know, the latest figure we have been able to get from witnesses as well as hospital sources is at least 300 people have been killed. It is just simply impossible that the protest and the confrontation could lead to such level of massacre. So while it is true that this religious group has had a history of tension, both with the Sunni sect as well as with the Nigerian military forces, what has just transpired from December 12th to December 14th in three locations is an extremely worrying situation which requires a very thorough, independent, impartial investigation.
What is Human Rights Watch's position regarding the arrest of the group's leader?
Yeah, the group's leader is arrested by the military, but there have been conflicting messages coming out of the authorities because we were first told he was under protective custody. And later on, there are reports emerging that he is arrested and he might be prosecuted. So we don't have detailed information of what offenses he is being charged under and what offenses he is being arrested currently. If he is accused of any offense, he should have been brought to court of law and he should have been charged with credible offense. In the absence of that, the arrest and detention itself might be questionable unless government has reason and evidence to prove that this is a protective custody.
Are you confident that an independent and impartial inquiry, as you call it, can be held in this incident?
We are concerned, but at the same time, we are hopeful that Nigeria will deliver an independent and impartial investigation. It's a step in the right direction that the governor of the state has announced the establishment of a judicial independent inquiry commission. But it is extremely crucial to ensure that this would be a completely independent and impartial investigation. Look, this is the military which is implicated in very serious abuses, and the Nigerian military has had history of abuses in the past. So it is extremely important to ensure its impartiality and independence, and we have reason to be concerned about it. But we hope that the new administration in Nigeria would ensure an independent and impartial investigation.
Daniel Bakala is Africa Director for Human Rights Watch from New York. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa. In other news from Nigeria, villagers in the northeast say Cameroonian troops searching for Boko Haram militants killed about 70 civilians Sunday. According to witnesses, the soldiers entered the Borno state village of Kirwa Jimni and asked for Boko Haram militants were hiding. They say the soldiers then began shooting. A local militia group spokesman says the soldiers were in hot pursuit of Boko Haram militants when they opened fire on the villagers. Protests in Ethiopia's Oromoya region have entered their second month. The Oromo people oppose a plan to expand the capital. They also say the government is preventing them from gaining any power. Martha van der Wolf reports from Gintji, one of the first towns where protests erupted in November.
Schools are closed. Businesses just reopened after being closed for almost a week, and there's tension in the small town of Gintji, about 80 kilometers west of Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Police are on the main road, and interviews have to be conducted on the basis of anonymity and on the outskirts of the town. One waitress says that despite the cafe being open again, things are not back to normal yet. She says there's not an official curfew and that young people risk being randomly detained if they are out in the evening. The most recent protest in Gintji was last weekend after a funeral. Citizens say security forces killed three people before the protest took place. Gintji is one of the first towns where demonstrations against the so-called Addis Ababa Master Plan started in mid-November. The plan is a blueprint to expand the capital city into the Oromia region. The protesters believe that an expansion of the capital will lead to land grabs without proper compensation and a loss of the Oromo culture and language. A shop owner who participated in the protest says those who created the master plan do not understand that life is tough and that people like himself will not benefit from the promised development. He says that there is no benefit for the people to have outside investors who take their land. He says that the investors only pay $1.50 a day and that they can't even eat from that amount. The Oromia region was established when the current government came to power in 1991. The federal system was divided along ethnic lines. The Oromos are the largest ethnic group in the country. Bekele Gerba, leader of the opposition group Oromo Federal Congress, lives in Adama, the former capital of the Oromia region. The city, about 60 kilometers south of Addis Ababa, has also seen protests in recent weeks. Bekele says Oromos have never been treated like equals by Ethiopia's leaders, but he believes the current government is the worst.
The ruling classes usually, they think that Oromo is a threat. One day they can overwhelm us. Therefore, they have to be treated in such a way so that they won't have any power. Therefore, for example, we don't have any power in the military. All the military commanders they belong to a different ethnic group.
Bekele's party says more than 75 people have died since the protests began and that many of his party members have been detained. Rights organizations such as Human Rights Watch say the government is using excessive lethal force on the protesters. A government spokesman, Gita Chureda, told VOA Wednesday that security forces have exercised restraint even under circumstances where they found themselves overwhelmed. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Islamist gunmen ambushed a bus traveling from Nairobi to Mandera, Kenya on Monday and demanded that passengers separate into groups of Christians and Muslims. But Muslim passengers refused these orders, protecting their Christian counterparts. Jill Craig has reaction from Nairobi.
Gunmen believed to be Al-Shabaab supporters shot at a bus in North Kenya's Mandera County Monday, killing two people. Nairobi tour driver Boniface Mbili says these Al-Shabaab attacks are causing anxiety and hurting the country's tourism industry.
Once they attack there, they bring a lot of scare to the country and to the economy. Because now people will be afraid of traveling, you know? Yeah? Because we are not safe. Anywhere you can't say you are safe. Because they can do it anywhere, you know? Especially in our transport sector.
But the passengers aboard the bus attacked Monday showed unusual bravery. Witnesses say some Muslim passengers gave headscarves to non-Muslims to help them conceal their identities, likely remembering a previous attack in Mandera last year when militants killed 28 non-Muslims taken off a bus. According to local officials, the attackers ordered everyone off the bus and to separate into two groups of Muslims and non-Muslims. But passengers refused, telling the militants to kill them all. The gunmen soon left. Nairobi resident Mahamud Mohammed says this show of solidarity demonstrates the Kenyan spirit.
And from now, we the Muslims will be the forefront to fight terrorism. You don't need to kill a brother of mine or my teacher or a doctor who is treating you. Somebody is coming, then separating you into two different religions, killing one and leaving other. That one is a coward attack, and the Muslim community must confront that. What they did was a heroic, and we really welcome it, and that is what we believe on.
Mohammed says the attack was un-Islamic.
Islam has nothing to do with terrorism, and attacking an innocent person, it's not permitted in Islam. According to the teaching of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, everybody should be a brother's keeper. So those attacks have nothing to do with Islam.
Al-Shabaab has staged a number of deadly attacks in Kenya since 2011, when the government sent troops into Somalia to fight the Al-Qaeda-linked group. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
The French news agency says the various rebel groups that have sprung up in Burundi are now united under one name, the Republican Forces of Burundi. The rebels claim their goals are to protect the population and uphold the Arusha Agreement that helped end the long civil war in 2006. They also say they want to oust President Nkurunziza from power. Violence erupted in Burundi in April when the president announced he would seek a third term. The opposition and others called that unconstitutional. Hundreds of people have died in violence since then. More migrants and refugees die today trying to reach Europe. Greek authorities say at least 13 people, mostly children, drowned when their small plastic boat sank near a Greek island. 15 others were rescued. Meanwhile, in Germany, police arrested a suspected smuggler. A 37-year-old Syrian man is charged with taking $2,400 from Syrian migrants and putting them on a small boat in bad weather. Police say the suspect was himself a refugee when he arrived in Germany last August. He could be sentenced to 3 years in prison if convicted of convicted of human rights trafficking, resulting in death. And there are more reports of xenophobia over the migrant and refugee crisis. A far-right group in Austria staged a mock beheading of two of its members who posed as migrants. The incident took place at a busy shopping center. Police watched the event, saying the protesters had the right of assembly. The Anti-Islam Freedom Party leads two centrist parties in the latest opinion polls in Austria. Nineteen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Residents of the Central African Republic capital, Bangui, say they are determined to vote in Sunday's election despite continued security concerns. But voting for people outside the capital and in refugee camps remains a concern. If elections take place, many people might not be able to vote. Katrina Hoya has more on the story.
For the first time since the Seleka rebels ousted a government in 2013, voters in Dakar are scheduled to select a new president and parliament. The question is when. Right now, the vote is still set for Sunday, December 27th, but that date may still change. 1.7 million people are registered to vote, according to the National Election Authority, or ANE, but many have yet to receive their voter cards. Ballots arrived this week and still need to be distributed across the country. There might not be enough time, says ANE logistics officer Muruba Sakanga.
Ah, d'accord.
We have very little time to organize the elections, and we had to rush, he says. The time to realize the elections is not really there. Despite this, we are doing all we can to be ready in time. The vote, whenever it takes place, will happen amid continued insecurity. The armed groups that ousted President Francois Bozize in March 2013 are still present in the capital, and in particular in the Muslim-majority neighborhood Pekasank. A resident there, Mohamed Saleh, says he wants to vote.
On sait jamais. Ils sont habitués dans le désordre, on sait jamais.
We have to vote for peace to return, but these people attacking us, they don't want peace to come back. They benefit from the chaos, he says. Logistical problems may be especially hard to surmount in areas outside the capital with a heavy military presence, like the town of Karno in the western part of the country and the town of Bosangoa about 200 kilometers north of the capital. George Sila, the ANE head of security. We, the army, have limited means to protect the population, he says. Outside of the capital, we depend on international forces, the French forces and the UN peacekeepers to make sure voters can cast their vote at polling stations. While some have called for elections to be postponed, France, which has a military presence in Dakar, and the UN peacekeeping mission, known as MINUSCA, are pushing for elections to take place as scheduled. Elections are the only way to help the car out of the country's three-year crisis, says Guret Mayanga, a taxi driver.
Oui, les élections, madame, je peux vous dire que les élections peuvent.
The elections might bring peace, but what's really needed, however, is a change of the population's mindset, he says. Real peace can only come through the heart. 38% of the registered voters cast ballots in last week's constitutional referendum. Those who hadn't received voter cards were allowed to use the cards receipt. It's not clear if this will be possible when the national elections take place. Katrina Heyer for VA News, Bangui.
In related news, Reuters reports a rebel leader in Northern Central Africa Republic has ended his opposition to Sunday's election. Nuruddin Adam leads a faction of the former Seleka rebel coalition. The government had declared him public enemy number one. Adam had declared the territory under his control an autonomous state. Ending his opposition would be a major boost to the presidential and legislative elections. The Swiss city of Geneva may be on course to reemerge as the peace capital of the world next year, a position it held in the final two decades of the last century. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA on peace activities planned for 2015 at UN European headquarters in the city.
In the 1980s, Geneva was abuzz with U.S.-Soviet bilateral nuclear arms control talks. The city hosted U.S. President Ronald Reagan and his Soviet counterpart Mikhail Gorbachev. Other peace activities included efforts to bring long-running wars in Afghanistan and Lebanon to an end. The collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989 hastened the breakup of the former Republic of Yugoslavia and triggered the start of the Balkan Wars. UN-mediated peace talks aimed at resolving the wars became an ongoing feature throughout the 1990s. The Director General of the UN Office in Geneva, Michael Moller, does not think those days are likely to return. But he believes Geneva and the United Nations will play an increasingly prominent role as the center for peace in the coming year. He says another round of peace talks on Yemen will begin January 14th. He says this will be followed by Syrian peace negotiations toward the end of January. In the meantime, he says UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura is traveling widely and establishing contact with the relevant parties.
Everybody is on board, almost everybody. wants these talks to be successful so that we can finally get a political solution to this really unacceptable problem.
The United Nations hosted two rounds of Syrian peace talks in 2014. Both ended in failure. Last week, the Security Council approved a diplomatic roadmap making it possible for talks to resume. Mueller says Geneva and the United Nations continue to be the hub for peace negotiations and conflict resolution.
As the world continues to be fragmented, Geneva becomes more and more a place of choice because of its neutrality, because of its reputation as a place where you can do the business of peace without other agendas interfering.
Mueller notes the United Nations this year hosted around 10,000 meetings and conferences. They included four mediation processes and multiple rounds of negotiations at UN headquarters and other venues in Geneva and Switzerland. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
All of the 150 people with suspected cases of Ebola in Liberia's most recent outbreak have been declared negative and reintegrated with little problem into their community. Prince Collins reports from near Monrovia. It is a stark change from last year when fear, lack of education, and community resistance left survivors and victim contacts ostracized.
38-year-old Sebastian Dean sits in front of his house in Liberia's cowfield community in Pinsville, on the outskirts of Monrovia, watching his kids play soccer with other neighborhood children. Dean, a nurse, and his family were among the more than 150 people who were quarantined for 21 days after having come into contact with a 15-year-old boy, Nathan Gbotu, who died from Ebola last month. They were released from the quarantine center on December 11. Despite initial fears of stigma, Dean says his family was welcomed back into the community.
My friends, brothers, whosoever, everybody coming around, it was necessary, and they were highly welcome us. Yes, the community, the community, I even thank the community chairman, the community people, every one of them, I mean, they were in line with us. And today we are all living happily. No stigmatization.
More than 10,000 Liberians have contracted Ebola since the outbreak began in early 2014, and more than 4,000 died. For a long time, many survivors and the families of victims were shunned and ostracized due to fear of the virus. But now things have begun to change. Cowfield Community Chairman Thomas Plato says upon hearing that his community was affected, he and his neighbors worked to create awareness on stigmatization.
We were very much happy to have received them from the ETU. I performed the welcoming ceremony by becoming the first person to shake all of their hands. So normally when you are pronounced Ebola survivor or patient, it stigmatizes you. But since we are getting to understand what is Ebola and how it works and what is the preventive measure, so we totally realize that we can't get the Ebola from them when they are already being pronounced survivor.
Dr. Mosoka Fala of Liberia's Ministry of Health said he has been working with the community to show them that stigma is not helpful.
We've learned a lot. Out of the dark episode of the Ebola crisis, there have been some good things we can look back to. Community perception has changed a lot, and it's in our field to work with that. And the experiences we learn from Ebola can be used to attack all essential health issues in our country. Communities are resourceful. We need to take advantage of that to address issues like healthcare and other things.
Liberia is now counting down a 42-day incubation period in order to be declared Ebola-free for the third time. Prince Collins for VOA News, Monrovia.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.